Hadn't James said the same thing earlier in his own way? Let sanguine healthy-mindedness do its best with its strange power of living in the moment and ignoring and forgetting. Still, the evil background is really there to be thought of, and the skull will grin in at the banquet. The difference in these two statements is not so much in the imagery and style as in the fact that Zilborg's comes almost a half-century later, and is based on that much more real clinical work, not only on philosophical speculation or personal intuition. But it also continues the straight line of development from James and the post-Darwinians, who saw the fear of death as a biological and evolutionary problem. Here, I think he is on very sound ground, and I especially like the way he puts the case. Zilborg points out that this fear is actually an expression of the instinct of self-preservation, which functions as a constant drive to maintain life and to master the dangers that threaten life. Such constant expenditure of psychological energy on the business of preserving life would be impossible if the fear of death were not as constant. The very term self-preservation implies an effort against some force of disintegration. The effective aspect of this is fear. Fear of death. In other words, the fear of death must be present behind all our normal functioning, in order for the organism to be armed toward self-preservation. But the fear of death cannot be present constantly in one's mental functioning, else the organism could not function. Zilborg continues, "If this fear were as constantly conscious, we should be unable to function normally. It must be properly repressed to keep us living with any modicum of comfort. We know very well that to repress means more than to put away and to forget that which was put away and the place where we put it. It means also to maintain a constant psychological effort to keep the lid on, and inwardly never relax our watchfulness." And so we can understand what seems like an impossible paradox. The ever-present fear of death in the normal biological functioning of our instinct of self-preservation, as well as our utter obliviousness to this fear in our conscious life. Therefore, in normal times, we move about actually without ever believing in our own death, as if we fully believed in our own corporeal immortality. We are intent on mastering death. A man will say, of course, that he knows he will die some day, but he does not really care. He is having a good time with living, and he does not think about death and does not care to bother about it. But this is a purely intellectual, verbal admission. The affect of fear is repressed. The argument from biology and evolution is basic and has to be taken seriously. I don't see how it can be left out of any discussion. Animals, in order to survive, have had to be protected by fear responses in relation not only to other animals but to nature itself. They had to see the real relationship of their limited powers to the dangerous world in which they were immersed. Reality and fear go together naturally. As the human infant is in an even more exposed and helpless situation, it is foolish to assume that the fear response of animals would have disappeared in such a weak and highly sensitive species. It is more reasonable to think that it was instead heightened, as some of the early Darwinians thought. Early men who were most afraid were those who were most realistic about their situation in nature, and they passed on to their offspring a realism that had a high survival value. The result was the emergence of man as we know him, a hyper-anxious animal who constantly invents reasons for anxiety, even where there are none. The argument from psychoanalysis is less speculative and has to be taken even more seriously. It showed us something about the child's inner world that we had never realized. Namely, that it was more filled with terror, the more the child was different from other animals. We could say that fear is programmed into the lower animals by ready-made instincts. But an animal who has no instincts has no programmed fears. Man's fears are fashioned out of the ways in which he perceives the world. Now, what is unique about the child's perception of the world? For one thing, the extreme confusion of cause and effect relationships. For another, extreme unreality about the limits of his own powers. The child lives in a situation of utter dependence, and when his needs are met, it must seem to him that he has magical powers, real omnipotence. If he experiences pain, hunger, or discomfort, all he has to do is to scream, and he is relieved and lulled by gentle, loving sounds. He is a magician and a telepath who has only to mumble and to imagine, and the world turns to his desires. But now the penalty for such perceptions. In a magical world where things cause other things to happen just by a mere thought or a look of displeasure, anything can happen to anyone. When the child experiences inevitable and real frustrations from his parents, he directs hate and destructive feelings toward them. And he has no way of knowing that malevolent feelings cannot be fulfilled by the same magic as were his other wishes. Psychoanalysts believe that this confusion is a main cause of guilt and helplessness in the child. In his very fine essay, Wall summed up this paradox. The socialization processes for all children are painful and frustrating, and hence no child escapes forming hostile death wishes towards his socializers. Therefore, none escape the fear of personal death in either direct or symbolic form. Repression is usually immediate and effective. The child is too weak to take responsibility for all this destructive feeling, and he can't control the magical execution of his desires. This is what we mean by an immature ego. The child doesn't have the sure ability to organize his perceptions and his relationship to the world. He can't control his own activity, and he doesn't have sure command over the acts of others. He thus has no real control over the magical cause and effect that he senses, either inside himself or outside in nature and in others. His destructive wishes could explode, his parents' wishes likewise. The forces of nature are confused, externally and internally. And for a weak ego, this fact makes for quantities of exaggerated potential power and added terror. The result is that the child, at least some of the time, lives with an inner sense of chaos that other animals are immune to. Ironically, even when the child makes out real cause and effect relationships, they become a burden to him because he overgeneralizes them. One such generalization is what the psychoanalysts call the Talion principle. The child crushes insects, sees the cat eat a mouse and make it vanish, joins with the family to make a pet rabbit disappear into their interiors, and so on. He comes to know something about the power relations of the world, but can't give them relative value. The parents could eat him and make him vanish, and he could likewise eat them. When the father gets a fierce glow in his eyes as he clubs a rat, the watching child might also expect to be clubbed, especially if he has been thinking bad magical thoughts. I don't want to seem to make an exact picture of processes that are still unclear to us, or to make out that all children live in the same world and have the same problems. Also, I wouldn't want to make the child's world seem more lurid than it really is most of the time. But I think it is important to show the painful contradictions that must be present in it at least some of the time, and to show how fantastic a world it surely is for the first few years of the child's life. Perhaps then we could understand better why Zilborg said that the fear of death undergoes most complex elaborations and manifests itself in many indirect ways. Or, as Wall so perfectly put it, death is a complex symbol and not any particular sharply defined thing to the child. The child's concept of death is not a single thing, but it is rather a composite of mutually contradictory paradoxes. Death itself is not only a state, but a complex symbol, the significance of which will vary from one person to another and from one culture to another. We could understand, too, why children have their recurrent nightmares, their universal phobias of insects and mean dogs. In their tortured interiors radiate complex symbols of many inadmissible realities. Terror of the world, the horror of one's own wishes, the fear of vengeance by the parents, the disappearance of things, one's lack of control over anything, really. It is too much for any animal to take, but the child has to take it, and so he wakes up screaming with almost punctual regularity during the period when his weak ego is in the process of consolidating things. The disappearance of the fear of death. Yet the nightmares become more and more widely spaced, and some children have more than others. We are back again to the beginning of our discussion. To those who do not believe that the fear of death is normal, who think that it is a neurotic exaggeration that draws on bad early experiences. Otherwise, they say, how explain that so many people, the vast majority, seem to survive the flurry of childhood nightmares and go on to live a healthy, more or less optimistic life, untroubled by death? As Montaigne said, the peasant has a profound indifference and a patience toward death and the sinister side of life. And if we say that this is because of his stupidity, then let's all learn from stupidity. Today, when we know more than Montaigne, we would say, let's all learn from repression. But the moral would have just as much weight. Repression takes care of the complex symbol of death for most people. But its disappearance doesn't mean that the fear was never there. The argument of those who believe in the universality of the innate terror of death rests its case mostly on what we know about how effective repression is. The argument can probably never be cleanly decided. If you claim that a concept is not present because it is repressed, you can't lose. It is not a fair game, intellectually, because you always hold the trump card. This type of argument makes psychoanalysis seem unscientific to many people. The fact that its proponents can claim that someone denies one of their concepts because he represses his consciousness of its truth. But repression is not a magical word for winning arguments. It is a real phenomenon, and we have been able to study many of its workings. This study gives its legitimacy as a scientific concept and makes it a more or less dependable ally in our argument. For one thing, there is a growing body of research trying to get at the consciousness of death denied by repression that uses psychological tests, such as measuring galvanic skin responses. It strongly suggests that underneath the most bland exterior lurks the universal anxiety, the worm at the core. For another thing, there is nothing like shocks in the real world to jar loose repressions. Recently, psychiatrists reported an increase in anxiety neuroses in children as a result of the earth tremors in Southern California. For these children, the discovery that life really includes cataclysmic danger was too much for their still imperfect denial systems, hence open outbursts of anxiety. With adults, we see this manifestation of anxiety in the face of impending catastrophe, where it takes the form of panic. Recently, several people suffered broken limbs and other injuries after forcing open their airplane's safety door during takeoff and jumping from the wing to the ground. The incident was triggered by the backfire of an engine. Obviously, underneath these harmless noises, other things are rumbling in the creature. But even more important is how repression works. It is not simply a negative force opposing life energies. It lives on life energies and uses them creatively. I mean that fears are naturally absorbed by expansive organismic striving. Nature seems to have built into organisms an innate healthy-mindedness. It expresses itself in self-delight, in the pleasure of unfolding one's capacities into the world, in the incorporation of things in that world, and in feeding on its limitless experiences. This is a lot of very positive experience, and when a powerful organism moves with it, it gives contentment. As Santayana once put it, a lion must feel more secure that God is on his side than a gazelle. On the most elemental level, the organism works actively against its own fragility, by seeking to expand and perpetuate itself in living experience. Instead of shrinking, it moves toward more life. Also, it does one thing at a time, avoiding needless distractions from all-absorbing activity. In this way, it would seem fear of death can be carefully ignored or actually absorbed in the life-expanding processes. Occasionally, we seem to see such a vital organism on the human level. I am thinking of the portrait of Zorba the Greek, drawn by Nikos Kazantzakis. Zorba was an ideal of the nonchalant victory of all-absorbing daily passion over timidity and death, and he purged others in his life-affirming flame. But Kazantzakis himself was no Zorba, which is partly why the character of Zorba rang a bit false. Nor are most other men. Still, everyone enjoys a working amount of basic narcissism, even though it is not a lion's. The child who is well-nourished and loved develops, as we said, a sense of magical omnipotence, a sense of his own indestructibility, a feeling of proven power and secure support. He can imagine himself deep down to be eternal. We might say that his repression of the idea of his own death is made easy for him because he is fortified against it in his very narcissistic vitality. This type of character probably helped Freud to say that the unconscious does not know death. Anyway, we know that basic narcissism is increased when one's childhood experiences have been securely life-supporting and warmly enhancing to the sense of self, to the feeling of being really special, truly number one in creation. The result is that some people have more of what the psychoanalyst Leon J. Saul has aptly called inner sustainment. It is a sense of bodily confidence in the face of experience that sees the person more easily through severe life crises and even sharp personality changes. It almost seems to take the place of the directive instincts of lower animals. One can't help thinking of Freud again, who had more inner sustainment than most men, thanks to his mother and favorable early environment. He knew the confidence and courage that it gave to a man, and he himself faced up to life and to a fatal cancer with a stoic heroism. Again, we have evidence that the complex symbol of fear of death would be very variable in its intensity. It would be, as Wall concluded, profoundly dependent upon the nature and the vicissitudes of the developmental process. But I want to be careful not to make too much of natural vitality and inner sustainment. As we will see in Chapter 6, even the unusually favored Freud suffered his whole life from phobias and from death anxiety, and he came to fully perceive the world under the aspect of natural terror. I don't believe that the complex symbol of death is ever absent, no matter how much vitality and inner sustainment a person has. Even more, if we say that these powers make repression easy and natural, we are only saying the half of it. Actually, they get their very power from repression. Psychiatrists argue that the fear of death varies in intensity depending on the developmental process, and I think that one important reason for this variability is that the fear is transmuted in that process. If the child has had a very favorable upbringing, it only serves all the better to hide the fear of death. After all, repression is made possible by the natural identification of the child with the powers of his parents. If he has been well cared for, identification comes easily and solidly, and his parents' powerful triumph over death automatically becomes his. What is more natural to banish one's fears than to live on delegated powers? And what does the whole growing-up period signify, if not the giving over of one's life project? I'm going to be talking about these things all the way through this book, and do not want to develop them in this introductory discussion. What we will see is that man cuts out for himself a manageable world. He throws himself into action uncritically, unthinkingly. He accepts the cultural programming that turns his nose where he is supposed to look. He doesn't bite the world off in one piece as a giant would, but in small, manageable pieces, as a beaver does. He uses all kinds of techniques, which we call the character defenses. He learns not to expose himself, not to stand out. He learns to embed himself in other power, both of concrete persons and of things and cultural commands. The result is that he comes to exist in the imagined infallibility of the world around him. He doesn't have to have fears when his feet are solidly mired and his life mapped out in a ready-made maze. All he has to do is to plunge ahead in a compulsive style of drivenness in the ways of the world that the child learns and in which he lives later as a kind of grim equanimity, the strange power of living in the moment and ignoring and forgetting, as James put it. This is the deeper reason that Montaigne's peasant isn't troubled until the very end, when the angel of death, who has always been sitting on his shoulder, extends his wing, or at least until he is prematurely startled into dumb awareness, like the husbands in John Cassavetes' fine film. At times like this, when the awareness dawns that has always been blotted out by frenetic, ready-made activity, we see the transmutation of repression redistilled, so to speak, and the fear of death emerges in pure essence. This is why people have psychotic breaks when repression no longer works, when the forward momentum of activity is no longer possible. Besides, the peasant mentality is far less romantic than Montaigne would have us believe. The peasant's equanimity is usually immersed in a style of life that has elements of real madness, and so it protects him. An undercurrent of constant hate and bitterness expressed in feuding, bullying, bickering, and family quarrels, the petty mentality, the self-deprecation, the superstition, the obsessive control of daily life by a strict authoritarianism, and so on. As the title of a recent essay by Joseph Lopreiato has it, how would you like to be a peasant? We will also touch upon another large dimension in which the complex symbol of death is transmuted and transcended by man. Belief in immortality, the extension of one's being into eternity. Right now we can conclude that there are many ways that repression works to calm the anxious human animal, so that he need not be anxious at all. I think we have reconciled our two divergent positions on the fear of death. The environmental and the innate positions are both part of the same picture, They merge naturally into one another. It all depends from which angle you approach the picture, from the side of the disguises and transmutations of the fear of death, or from the side of its apparent absence. I admit with a sense of scientific uneasiness that whatever angle you use, you don't get at the actual fear of death, and so I reluctantly agree with Sharon that the argument can probably never be cleanly won. Nevertheless, something very important emerges. There are different images of man that he can draw and choose from. On the one hand, we see a human animal who is partly dead to the world, who is most dignified when he shows a certain obliviousness to his fate, when he allows himself to be driven through life, who is most free when he lives in secure dependency on powers around him, when he is at least in possession of himself. On the other hand, we get an image of a human animal who is overly sensitive to the world, who cannot shut it out, who is thrown back on his own meager powers, and who seems least free to move and act, least in possession of himself, and most undignified. Whichever image we choose to identify with depends in large part upon ourselves. Let us then explore and develop these images further to see what they reveal to us. Chapter 3. The Recasting of Some Basic Psychoanalytic Ideas. From the child of five to myself is but a step, but from the newborn baby to the child of five is an appalling distance. Leo Tolstoy. Now that we have outlined the argument in the first two chapters, it is time to fill in the details. Why exactly is the world so terrible for the human animal? Why do people have such trouble digging up the resources to face that terror openly and bravely? To talk about these things takes us right into the heart of psychoanalytic theory, and what is now the existential rebirth in psychology. It lays bare the nature of man with a clarity and comprehensiveness that are truly amazing. Man's Existential Dilemma. We always knew that there was something peculiar about man, something deep down that characterized him and set him apart from the other animals. It was something that had to go right to his core, something that made him suffer his peculiar fate, that made it impossible to escape. For ages, when philosophers talked about the core of man, they referred to it as his essence, something fixed in his nature, deep down, some special quality or substance. But nothing like it was ever found. Man's peculiarity still remained a dilemma. The reason it was never found, as Eric Fromm put it in an excellent discussion, was that there was no essence, that the essence of man is really his paradoxical nature, the fact that he is half animal and half symbolic. As we shall see in Chapter 5, it was Kierkegaard who forcefully introduced the existential paradox into modern psychology, with his brilliant analysis of the Adam and Eve myth that had conveyed that paradox to the Western mind for all time. In recent times, every psychologist who has done vital work has made this paradox the main problem of his thought. Otto Rank, to whom I want to devote special chapters later on, more consistently and brilliantly than anyone else since Kierkegaard, Carl Jung, Eric Fromm, Rollo May, Ernest Schachtel, Abraham Maslow, Harold F. Searles, Norman O'Brown, Laura Pearls, and others. We might call this existential paradox the condition of individuality within finitude. Man has a symbolic identity that brings him sharply out of nature. He is a symbolic self, a creature with a name, a life history. He is a creator with a mind that soars out to speculate about atoms and infinity, who can place himself imaginatively at a point in space and contemplate bemusedly his own planet. This immense expansion, this dexterity, this ethereality, this self-consciousness gives to man literally the status of a small god in nature, as the Renaissance thinkers knew. Yet, at the same time, as the Eastern sages also knew, man is a worm and food for worms. This is the paradox. He is out of nature and hopelessly in it. He is dual, up in the stars and yet housed in a heart-pumping, breath-gasping body that once belonged to a fish and still carries the gill marks to prove it. His body is a material, fleshy casing that is alien to him in many ways, the strangest and most repugnant way being that it aches and bleeds and will decay and die. Man is literally split in two. He has an awareness of his own splendid uniqueness in that he sticks out of nature with a towering majesty, and yet he goes back into the ground a few feet in order blindly and dumbly to rot and disappear forever. It is a terrifying dilemma to be in and to have to live with. The lower animals are, of course, spared this painful contradiction, as they lack a symbolic identity and the self-consciousness that goes with it. They merely act and move reflexively as they are driven by their instincts. If they pause at all, it is only a physical pause. Inside, they are anonymous, and even their faces have no name. They live in a world without time, pulsating, as it were, in a state of dumb being. This is what has made it so simple to shoot down whole herds of buffalo or elephants. The animals don't know that death is happening and continue grazing placidly while others drop alongside them. The knowledge of death is reflexive and conceptual, and animals are spared it. They live and they disappear with the same thoughtlessness. A few minutes of fear, a few seconds of anguish, and it is over. But to live a whole life with the fate of death haunting one's dreams and even the most sun-filled days, that's something else. It is only if you let the full weight of this paradox sink down on your mind and feelings that you can realize what an impossible situation it is for an animal to be in. I believe that those who speculate that a full apprehension of man's condition would drive him insane are right, quite literally right. Babies are occasionally born with gills and tails, but this is not publicized. Instead, it is hushed up. Who wants to face up fully to the creatures we are, clawing and gasping for breath in a universe beyond our ken? I think such events illustrate the meaning of Pascal's chilling reflection. Men are so necessarily mad that not to be mad would amount to another form of madness. Necessarily because the existential dualism makes an impossible situation an excruciating dilemma. Mad because, as we shall see, everything that man does in his symbolic world is an attempt to deny and overcome his grotesque fate. He literally drives himself into a blind obliviousness with social games, psychological tricks, personal preoccupations so far removed from the reality of his situation, that they are forms of madness, agreed madness, shared madness, disguised and dignified madness, but madness all the same. Character traits, said Sandor Ferenczi, one of the most brilliant minds of Freud's intimate circle of early psychoanalysts, are secret psychoses. This is not a smug witticism offered in passing by a young science drunk with its own explanatory power and success. It is a mature scientific judgment of the most devastating self-revelatory kind ever fashioned by man trying to understand himself. Ferenczi had already seen behind the tight-lipped masks, the smiling masks, the earnest masks, the satisfied masks that people use to bluff the world and themselves about their secret psychoses. More recently, Erich Fromm wondered why most people did not become insane in the face of the existential contradiction between a symbolic self that seems to give man infinite worth in a timeless scheme of things, and a body that is worth about 98 cents. How to reconcile the two? In order to understand the weight of the dualism of the human condition, we have to know that the child can't really handle either end of it. The most characteristic thing about him is that he is precocious or premature. His world piles up on him and he piles up on himself. He has right from the beginning an exquisite sensory system that rapidly develops to take in all the sensations of his world with an extreme finesse. Add to it the quick development of language and the sense of self, and pile it all upon a helpless infant body trying vainly to grab the world correctly and safely. The result is ludicrous. The child is overwhelmed by experiences of the dualism of the self and the body from both areas, since he can be master of neither. He is not a confident social self, adept manipulator of symbolic categories of words, thoughts, names, or places, or especially of time, that great mystery for him. He doesn't even know what a clock is. Nor is he a functioning adult animal, who can work and procreate, do the serious things he sees happening around him. He can't do like father in any way. He is a prodigy in limbo. In both halves of his experience, he is dispossessed, yet impressions keep pouring in on him and sensations keep welling up within him, flooding his body. He has to make some kind of sense out of them, establish some kind of ascendancy over them. Will it be thoughts over body or body over thoughts? Not so easy. There can be no clear-cut victory or straightforward solution of the existential dilemma he is in. It is his problem right from the beginning almost of his life. Yet he is only a child to handle it. Children feel hounded by symbols they don't understand the need of, verbal demands that seem picayune, and rules and codes that call them away from their pleasure in the straightforward expression of their natural energies. And when they try to master the body, pretend it isn't there, act like a little man, the body suddenly overwhelms them, submerges them in vomit or excrement, and the child breaks down in desperate tears over his melted pretense at being a purely symbolic animal. Often the child deliberately soils himself or continues to wet the bed, to protest against the imposition of artificial symbolic rules. He seems to be saying that the body is his primary reality, and that he wants to remain in the simpler physical Eden, and not be thrown out into the world of right and wrong. In this way, we realize directly and poignantly that what we call the child's character is a modus vivendi, achieved after the most unequal struggle any animal has to go through. A struggle that the child can never really understand because he doesn't know what is happening to him, why he is responding as he does, or what is really at stake in the battle. The victory in this kind of battle is truly Pyrrhic. Character is a face that one sets to the world, but it hides an inner defeat. The child emerges with a name, a family, a play world, and a neighborhood, all clearly cut out for him. But his insides are full of nightmarish memories of impossible battles, terrifying anxieties of blood, pain, aloneness, darkness, mixed with limitless desires, sensations of unspeakable beauty, majesty, awe, mystery, and fantasies and hallucinations of mixtures between the two. The impossible attempt to compromise between bodies and symbols. We shall see in a few pages how sexuality enters in with its very definite focus, to further confuse and complicate the child's world. To grow up at all is to conceal the mass of internal scar tissue that throbs in our dreams. So we see that the two dimensions of human existence, the body and the self, can never be reconciled seamlessly, which explains the second half of Pascal's reflection. Not to be mad would amount to another form of madness. Here, Pascal proves that great students of human nature could see behind the masks of men long before scientific psychoanalysis. They lacked clinical documentation, but they saw that the coolest repression, the most convincing equanimity, or the warmest self-satisfaction were accomplished lies both toward the world and to oneself. With the clinical documentation of psychoanalytic thought, we got a fairly comprehensive picture of human character styles, what we can now call styles of madness, after Pascal. We might say that psychoanalysis revealed to us the complex penalties of denying the truth of man's condition, what we might call the costs of pretending not to be mad. If we had to offer the briefest explanation of all the evil that men have wreaked upon themselves and upon their world since the beginnings of time, right up until tomorrow, it would be not in terms of man's animal heredity, his instincts, and his evolution. It would be simply in the toll that his pretense of sanity takes, as he tries to deny his true condition. But more of this vital idea later. The meaning of anality. A sensitive thinker in the age of Freud has had to live a tortured intellectual life. At least this is an autobiographical reflection. There seems to be so much truth in the Freudian worldview, and at the same time so much of it seems so wrong-headed. The ambiguities of Freud's legacy were not in the wrong ideas that he had, since it has been relatively easy to lay these aside. The problem has been in his brilliantly true insights, which were stated in a way that they fell just to one side of reality, and we needed an immense amount of work and clarification in order to bring the two into line. Actually, what was needed was a framework into which to fit the corpus of psychoanalytic insight, so that the truth of it could emerge clearly and unambiguously, free of the 19th century reductionism, instinctivism, and biologism that Freud fettered it with. This framework is the existential one. Reinterpretations of Freud within an existential context give his insights their full scientific stature. This goal was recently achieved brilliantly by Norman O. Brown in his reinterpretation of the idea of anality and its central role in psychoanalytic theory. Probably the main value of that book, historically, is that it has reclaimed the most esoteric and inverted of the Freudian ideas and has made them the property of the human sciences. I am tempted to quote lavishly from the analytic riches of Brown's book, but there is no point in repeating what he has already written. Let us just observe that the basic key to the problem of anality is that it reflects the dualism of man's condition, his self and his body. Anality and its problems arise in childhood because it is then that the child already makes the alarming discovery that his body is strange and fallible and has a definite ascendancy over him by its demands and needs. Try as he may to take the greatest flights of fancy, he must always come back to it. Strangest and most degrading of all is the discovery that the body has, located in the lower rear and out of sight, a hole from which stinking smells emerge, and even more, a stinking substance, most disagreeable to everyone else, and eventually even to the child himself. At first, the child is amused by his anus and feces, and gaily inserts his finger into the orifice, smelling it, smearing feces on the walls, playing games of touching objects with his anus and the like. This is a universal form of play that does the serious work of all play. It reflects the discovery and exercise of natural bodily functions. It masters an area of strangeness. It establishes power and control over the deterministic laws of the natural world. And it does all this with symbols and fancy. Note: as anal play is an essential exercise in human mastery, it is better not interfered with. If the adult anxiously cuts it short, then he charges the animal function with an extra dose of anxiety. It becomes more threatening and has to be extra denied and extra avoided as an alien part of oneself. This extra grim denial is what we mean by the anal character. An anal upbringing, then, would be an affirmation via intense repression of the horror of the degrading animal body as the human burden sans pareil. End of note. With anal play, the child is already becoming a philosopher of the human condition. But like all philosophers, he is still bound by it, and his main task in life becomes the denial of what the anus represents, that in fact he is nothing but body so far as nature is concerned. Nature's values are bodily values, human values are mental values, and though they take the loftiest flights, they are built upon excrement, impossible without it, always brought back to it. As Montaigne put it, on the highest throne in the world, man sits on his arse. Usually this epigram makes people laugh, because it seems to reclaim the world from artificial pride and snobbery, and to bring things back to egalitarian values. But if we push the observation even further and say men sit not only on their arse, but over a warm and fuming pile of their own excrement, the joke is no longer funny. The tragedy of man's dualism, his ludicrous situation, becomes too real. The anus and its incomprehensible, repulsive product represents not only physical determinism and boundness, but the fate as well of all that is physical, decay and death. We now understand that what psychoanalysts have called anality or anal character traits are really forms of the universal protest against accident and death. Seen in this way, a large part of the most esoteric psychoanalytic corpus of insights achieves a new vitality and meaningfulness. To say that someone is anal means that someone is trying extra hard to protect himself against the accidents of life and danger of death, trying to use the symbols of culture as a sure means of triumph over natural mystery, trying to pass himself off as anything but an animal. When we comb the anthropological literature, we find that men everywhere have been anal in some basic levels of their cultural strivings, and we find that primitives have often shown the most unashamed anality of all. They have been more innocent about what their real problem is, and they have not well disguised their disguise, so to speak, over the fallibilities of the human condition. We read that men of the Chaga tribe wear an anal plug all their lives, pretending to have sealed up the anus and not to need to defecate, an obvious triumph over mere physicalness. Or take the widespread practice of segregating women in special huts during menstruation and all the various taboos surrounding menstruation. It is obvious that man seeks to control the mysterious processes of nature as they manifest themselves within his own body. The body cannot be allowed to have the ascendancy over him. Anality explains why men yearn for freedom from contradictions and ambiguities, why they like their symbols pure, their truth with a capital T. On the other hand, when men really want to protest against artificialities, when they rebel against the symbolisms of culture, they fall back on the physical. They call thoughts down to earth, mannerisms back to basic chemistry. A perfect example of this was in the recent anal film, Brewster McLeod, where speeches, official badges, and shiny manufactured surfaces were pummeled from the sky with obliterating excrement. The message was one that the modern filmmakers are making with great daring, calling the world back from hypocrisy by stressing basic things about life and the body. Stanley Kubrick jarred audiences when he showed in 2001 how man stepped out into space like an ape dancing to schmaltzy Strauss waltz music. And again, in A Clockwork Orange, he showed how naturally and satisfying a man can murder and rape in tune with the heroic transcendence of Beethoven's Ninth. The upsetting thing about anality is that it reveals that all culture, all man's creative life ways, are in some basic part of them a fabricated protest against natural reality, a denial of the truth of the human condition, and an attempt to forget the pathetic creature that man is. One of the most stunning parts of Brown's study was his presentation of anality in Jonathan Swift. The ultimate horror for Swift was the fact that the sublime, the beautiful, and the divine are inextricable from basic animal functions. In the head of the adoring male is the illusion that sublime beauty is all head and wings, with no bottom to betray it. In one of Swift's poems, a young man explains the grotesque contradiction that is tearing him apart. "Nor wonder how I lost my wits. Oh, Celia, Celia, Celia shits." In other words, in Swift's mind, there was an absolute contradiction between the state of being in love and an awareness of the excremental function of the beloved. Erwin Strauss, in his brilliant monograph on obsession, similarly earlier showed how repulsed Swift was by the animality of the body, by its dirt and decay. Strauss pronounced a more clinical judgment on Swift's disgust, seeing it as part of the typical obsessive's worldview. For all obsessives, sex is severed from unification and procreation. Through the isolation of the genitals from the whole of the body, sexual functions are experienced as excretions and as decay. This degree of fragmentation is extreme, but we all see the world through obsessive eyes at least part of the time and to some degree. And as Freud said, not only neurotics take exception to the fact that we are born between urine and feces. In this horror of the incongruity of man, Swift the poet gives more tormented voice to the dilemma that haunts us all, and it is worth summing it up one final time. Excreting is the curse that threatens madness because it shows man his abject finitude, his physicalness, the likely unreality of his hopes and dreams. But even more immediately, it represents man's utter bafflement at the sheer nonsense of creation. To fashion the sublime miracle of the human face, the mysterium tremendum of radiant feminine beauty, the veritable goddesses that beautiful women are, to bring this out of nothing, out of the void, and make it shine in noonday. To take such a miracle and put miracles again within it, deep in the mystery of eyes that peer out, the eye that gave even the dry Darwin a chill. To do all this and to combine it with an anus that shits, it is too much. Nature mocks us, and poets live in torture. I have tried to recapture just a bit of the shock of a scientific and poetic discussion of the problem of anality, and if I have succeeded in such an offhand way, we can understand what the existential paradox means. That what bothers people is really incongruity, life as it is. This view leads to a whole re-examination of Freudian theory, not only of the problem of anality, but also of Freud's central idea, the Oedipus complex. Let us now linger on this, again using Brown's brilliant reformulation. The Oedipal Project. Freud often tended to understand human motives in what can be called a primitive way. Sometimes so much so that when disciples like Rank and Ferenczi pulled away from him, they accused him of simple-mindedness. The accusation is, of course, ludicrous, but there is something to it. Probably what they are driving at, the doggedness with which Freud stuck to his stark sexual formulas. No matter how much he changed later in life, he always kept alive the letter of psychoanalytic dogma and fought against a watering down of the motives he thought he uncovered. We will understand better why in a later chapter. Take the Oedipus complex. In his early work, Freud had said that this complex was the central dynamic in the psychic life. In his view, the boy child had innate drives of sexuality, and he even wanted to possess his mother. At the same time, he knew that his father was his competitor, and he held in check a murderous aggressiveness toward him. The reason he held it in check was that he knew the father was physically stronger than he, and that the result of an open fight would be the father's victory and the castration of the son. Hence the horror of blood, of mutilation, of the female genitals that seemed to have been mutilated. They testified that castration was a fact. Freud modified his views all through his life, but he never got a full distance away from them. No wonder. They kept being confirmed in some intimate way by the people he studied. There was indeed something about the anus and the genitals, the physicalness of the family, and its copulations, that weighed on the psyche of neurotics like an age-old stone. Freud thought that such a heavy weight must date from time immemorial, from the first emergence of humans out of primate ancestors. He thought that the guilt we each feel deep down is connected with a primal crime of patricide and incest, committed in the dim recesses of prehistory. So deep is guilt ingrained, so much is it confused with the body, with sex and excrement, and with the parents. Freud never abandoned his views, because they were correct in their elemental suggestiveness about the human condition. But not quite in the sense that he thought, or rather, not in the framework which he offered. Today we realize that all the talk about blood and excrement, sex and guilt, is true not because of urges to patricide and incest and fears of actual physical castration, but because all these things reflect man's horror of his own basic animal condition, a condition that he cannot, especially as a child, understand, and a condition that, as an adult, he cannot accept. The guilt that he feels over bodily processes and urges is pure guilt, guilt as inhibition, as determinism, as smallness and boundedness. It grows out of the constraint of the basic animal condition, the incomprehensible mystery of the body and the world. Psychoanalysts have been preoccupied since the turn of the century with the experiences of childhood. But strangely enough, it is only since just yesterday that we are able to put together a fairly complete and plausible commonsensical picture of why childhood is such a crucial period for man. We owe this picture to many people, including especially the neglected rank, but it is Norman O'Brown who has summed it up more pointedly and definitively than anyone else, I think. As he argued in his own reorientation of Freud, the Oedipus complex is not the narrowly sexual problem of lust and competitiveness that Freud made out in his early work. Rather, the Oedipus complex is the Oedipal project, a project that sums up the basic problem of the child's life, whether he will be a passive object of fate, an appendage of others, a plaything of the world, or whether he will be an active center within himself, whether he will control his own destiny with his own powers or not. As Brown put it, the Oedipal project is not, as Freud's earlier formulations suggest, a natural love of the mother, but as his later writings recognize, a product of the conflict of ambivalence and an attempt to overcome that conflict by narcissistic inflation. The essence of the Oedipal complex is the project of becoming God, in Spinoza's formula, causa sui. By the same token, it plainly exhibits infantile narcissism perverted by the flight from death. If the child's major task is a flight from helplessness and obliteration, then sexual matters are secondary and derivative. As Brown says, thus again, it appears that the sexual organizations, pregenital and genital, do not correspond to the natural distribution of eros in the human body. They represent a hypercathexis, a supercharge of particular bodily functions and zones, a hypercathexis induced by the fantasies of human narcissism in flight from death. Let us take these technical gems and spread them out a bit. The Oedipal project is the flight from passivity, from obliteration, from contingency. The child wants to conquer death by becoming the father of himself, the creator and sustainer of his own life. We saw in Chapter 2 that the child has an idea of death by the age of 3. But long before that, he is already at work to fortify himself against vulnerability. This process begins naturally in the very earliest stages of the infant's life, in what is called the oral stage. This is the stage before the child is fully differentiated from his mother in his own consciousness, before he is fully cognizant of his own body and its functions, or, as we say technically, before his body has become an object in his phenomenological field. The mother at this time represents literally the child's life world. During this period, her efforts are directed to the gratification of the child's wishes, to automatic relief of his tensions and pains. The child, then, at this time, is simply full of himself, an unflinchable manipulator and champion of his world. He lives suffused in his own omnipotence, and magically controls everything he needs to feed that omnipotence. He has only to cry to get food and warmth, to point to demand the moon, and get a delightful rattle in its place. No wonder we understand this period as characterized by primary narcissism. the child triumphantly controls his world by controlling the mother. His body is his narcissistic project, and he uses it to try to swallow the world. The anal stage is another way of talking about the period when the child begins to turn his attention to his own body as an object in his phenomenal field. He discovers it and seeks to control it. His narcissistic project, then, becomes the mastery and the possession of the world through self-control. At each stage in the unfolding discovery of his world and the problems that it poses, the child is intent on shaping that world to his own aggrandizement. He has to keep the feeling that he has absolute power and control, and in order to do that, he has to cultivate independence of some kind, the conviction that he is shaping his own life. That is why Brown, like Rank, could say that the Oedipal project is inevitably self-generated in the child and directed against the parents, irrespective of how the parents behave. To put it paradoxically, children toilet train themselves. The profound meaning of this is that there is no perfect way to bring up a child, since he brings himself up, by trying to shape himself into an absolute controller of his own destiny. As this aim is impossible, each character is, deeply and in some way, fantastically unreal, fundamentally imperfect. As Ferenczi so well summed it up, character is, from the point of view of the psychoanalyst, a sort of abnormality, a kind of mechanization of a particular way of reaction, rather similar to an obsessional symptom. The castration complex. In other words, the narcissistic project of self-creation, using the body as the primary base of operations, is doomed to failure. And the child finds it out. This is how we understand the power and meaning of what is called the castration complex, as Freud came to develop it in his later writings, and as Rank and Brown have detailed it. In the newer understanding of the castration complex, it is not the father's threats that the child reacts to. As Brown so well says, the castration complex comes into being solely in confrontation with the mother. This phenomenon is very crucial, and we must linger a bit on how it happens. It all centers on the fact that the mother monopolizes the child's world. At first, she is his world. The child cannot survive without her, yet in order to get control of his own powers, he has to get free of her. The mother thus represents two things to the child, and it helps us understand why the psychoanalysts have said that ambivalence characterizes the whole early growth period. On the one hand, the mother is a pure source of pleasure and satisfaction, a secure power to lean on. She must appear as the goddess of beauty and goodness, victory and power. This is her light side, we might say, and it is blindly attractive. But on the other hand, the child has to strain against this very dependency, or he loses the feeling that he has aegis over his own powers. That is another way of saying that the mother, by representing secure biological dependence, is also a fundamental threat. The child comes to perceive her as a threat, which is already the beginning of the castration complex in confrontation with her. The child observes that the mother's body is different from the male's, strikingly different, and this difference gradually comes to make him very uncomfortable. Freud never tried to ease the shock of the revelation of his theory, and he called this discomfort horror at the mutilated creature, the castrated mother, the sight of genitals devoid of a penis. Freud's shock effect seemed to many people to partake of caricature. The horror in the child's perceptions seemed too contrived, too pat, too much designed to fit into Freud's own addiction to sexual explanations and biological reductionism. Others, too, saw Freud's way of thinking as a reflection of his own ingrained patriarchy, his strong sense of masculine superiority, which made the woman seem naturally inferior if she lacked male appendages. The fact is that the horror at the mutilated creature is contrived, but it is the child who contrives it. Psychoanalysts reported faithfully what their neurotic patients told them, even if they had to pry just the right words into their expressions. What troubles neurotics, as it troubles most people, is their own powerlessness. They must find something to set themselves against. If the mother represents biological dependence, then the dependence can be fought against by focusing it on the fact of sexual differentiation. If the child is to be truly causa sui, then he must aggressively defy the parents in some way, move beyond them, and the threats and temptations they embody. The genitals are a small thing in the child's perceptual world, hardly enough to be traumatic just because they lack protuberance. As Brown so well put it, the horror is the child's own invention. It is a tissue of fantasy inseparable from his own fantastic project of becoming father of himself, and his fantasy only remotely connected with actual sight of the female genitalia. Or, put another way, we can say that the child fetishizes the mother's body as an object of global danger to himself. It is one way of cutting her down to size, depriving her of her primary place in creation. Using Erwin Strauss' formula, we would say that the child splits the mother's genitals off from her totality as a love object. They then come to be experienced as a threat, as decay. Penis envy. The real threat of the mother comes to be connected with her sheer physicalness. Her genitals are used as a convenient focus for the child's obsession with the problem of physicalness. If the mother is a goddess of light, she is also a witch of the dark. He sees her tie to the earth, her secret bodily processes that bind her to nature, the breast with its mysterious sticky milk, the menstrual odors and blood, the almost continual immersion of the productive mother in her corporeality, and not least, something the child is very sensitive to, the often neurotic and helpless character of this immersion. After the child gets hints about the mother's having babies, sees them being nursed, gets a good look at the toilet full of menstrual blood that seems to leave the witch quite intact and unconcerned, there is no question about her immersion in stark body meanings and body fallibilities. The mother must exude determinism, and the child expresses his horror at his complete dependency on what is physically vulnerable. And so we understand not only the boy's preference for masculinity, but also the girl's penis envy. Both boys and girls succumb to the desire to flee the sex represented by the mother. They need little coaxing to identify with the father and his world. He seems more neutral physically, more cleanly powerful, less immersed in body determinisms. He seems more symbolically free, represents the vast world outside of the home, the social world, with its organized triumph over nature, the very escape from contingency that the child seeks. Note. Penis envy, then, arises from the fact that the mother's genitals have been split off from her body as a focalization of the problem of decay and vulnerability. Bernard Brodsky remarks about his female patient. Her concept of woman as fecal greatly stimulated her penis envy, since the lively erectile penis was the antonym of the dead, inert stool. B. Brodsky, The Self-Representation, Anality, and the Fear of Dying. Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association, 1959, Volume 7, page 102. Phyllis Greenacre, outstanding student of the child's experiences, had already remarked on this same equation in the child's perception. Penis equals movement, therefore life. Feces equals inertia, therefore death. P. Greenacre, Trauma, Growth, and Personality, New York, Norton, 1952, page 264. This makes penis envy very natural. Greenacre even used the apt idea of penis awe to refer to the spell that the large male appendage can cast in the child's perceptions of the father. The child, after all, lives in a world of body power predominantly. He doesn't understand abstract or symbolic power. So more body equals more life. A grown woman might well experience a lingering of the same feeling. An indentation and lack of protuberance, with all that goes on inside, is different from an aggressive extension that must give less of a feeling of vulnerability. Brodsky's patient, as we might expect, was in trouble because both dimensions of her ambivalence toward her mother were heightened. The patient's need of her mother and the mother's threat to the patient. The mother's overprotection and hindrance of the patient's gaining motor skills contributed to the faulty development of the self-image. She had both intense separation anxiety and marked castration anxiety. In other words, her dependency was intensified, and at the same time, it intensified her castration anxiety, as she could not break away from an object that represented decay. This is an almost sure formula for clinical neurosis. End of note. Both the boy and girl turn away from the mother as a sort of automatic reflex of their own needs for growth and independence. But the horror, terror, contempt they feel is, as we said, part of their own fantastic perceptions of a situation they can't stand. This situation is not only the biological dependency and physicalness represented by the mother, but also the terrible revelation of the problem of the child's own body. The mother's body not only reveals a sex that threatens vulnerability and dependency, it reveals much more. It presents the problem of two sexes and so confronts the child with the fact that his body is itself arbitrary. It is not so much that the child sees that neither sex is complete in itself,